In this episode of Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks, we'll have Alan Turing resurrected, Aliens Beastly or Alienware's Beastly 18-core dual liquid-cooled GPU Area 51. It's crazy. Netgear's Cable Orbi Home Mesh goodness, 7-nanometer Zen 2, and Snapdragon's at 1,000. Next. Easy for me to say, right? Welcome back to the show we affectionately call Hot Hardware's 2.5 Geeks. I'm Dave Altavilla, and I have a gaggle of geeks with me. Well, a duo of geeks to make us a trio, or 2.5, as we say. Marco and Chris, how's it hanging?
Holy moly. You know what? It's not hanging. I'm so tense. Everything's just tight.
You get the pucker going? Is that it?
Yeah, exactly.
Figured I'd mix it up today. That was PG-13. It wasn't that
bad. We might as well offend everybody right off the gate. Just do it right. Get everybody mad as soon as we start and just roll with it.
Dive right into the craziness. Chris, you going to roll with us, or are you going to be all conservative and reserved?
It's been a weird week, man.
It's so true.
Yeah, we'll see how we hang in here.
I am pouring a beer. I'm pouring a beer right now, and I will show you it. I'm taking it out of the koozie that was keeping it cold. It is Two Hearted Ale with what looks like some sort of fish on it. I'm going to say that's a codfish. It is a perfectly balanced American IPA. Chris, what's your flavor today?
Yeah, we've got the water theme going on. I've got the Little Choppy, if I can get that to show up on the screen there. So Poppy Session Ale, so a little lighter on the alcohol content so you can slam them back during your lunch break, I think is the intention.
Back during your lunch break. Yeah, have that.
I think that's the origin of the Session Ale, because when they hit their break, they needed to be able to throw back a few beers before they got back to work, but it couldn't be too strong or they couldn't work. So thus, the Session Ale. You can session it.
I get you. Whatever happened to the good old days when you could tie one on with a 3-martini lunch and come back in the bag? I mean, come on.
You can still do that.
Labor laws.
HR yeah, just
may not last long.
What was that, Marco?
I said you can still do it. HR just frowns upon it.
Yeah. HR just crafts up special pink pieces of paper for you when you do it. Right. Well, I am HR here right now today, so we're all going to survive the 3-martini lunch, but welcome back everybody, and thanks for joining us. We are here Wednesdays at 5:30, or at least we try to be, and we have lots to talk about this week. We're going to burn through them though, because they're varied in sundry different types of headlines today from all over the map. But lots going on, a little bit more travel coming up. The launches continue. The new technology rollouts continue. Where do we begin? Let's begin with stuff that's near and dear to our hearts. Hopefully something that's not failing in our advancing years here among the team. Memory. Micron ramps production of GDDR6. I can say that three times fast. GDDR6 memory for NVIDIA GeForce GTX 20 Turing GPUs. I teased that we would be resurrecting Alan Turing. We don't know for sure that this memory is intended for NVIDIA's next generation Turing cards, but we did get a little peek at a prototype, and there's some interesting information there too. Marco, what do you know?
We know quite a bit about the memory. We're speculating where it's going to end up, but it's pretty safe speculation. So if you remember back to the GTX 1080 launch, just before that, Micron announced GDDR5X memory. And then lo and behold, that memory showed up on the GTX 1080. And it required some engineering effort on NVIDIA's part and, of course, Micron's part and other partners that make GDDR5X to make sure signaling was good, power was good, and that it was going to work. So it wasn't just a quick drop in. But now we have news of GDDR6. Now, GDDR6 is interesting because Other people are making it. Samsung, Hynix have already announced they're making GDDR6, but now Micron is on board. Micron has announced volume production, not just that they're going to offer GDDR6, but that it is in volume production now. They have an array of 8 gigabit, so 1 gigabyte chips in production now. And there's lots of tweaks and advancements over a current gen GDDR5. there are additional balls on the packaging, but GDDR6 is going to run at higher speeds. Out of a single package, the 12 gigabit per second can do 48 gigabytes per second of bandwidth. There's also a 14 gigabit offering that can do 56 gigabytes per second per chip. And eventually they're going to get to, I believe, a 16 gigabit package that's going to do 64 gigabytes a second. Now, over and above the higher speeds, the chips require fewer PCB layers, so easier to implement than previous generations. And they're also operating at lower voltages, so lower power than current GDDR5. So all told, what this announcement means, at least from Micron and the models that they're offering, are lower power, easier to implement, and higher bandwidth memory for graphics cards, AI, networking applications. But GDDR6 is, you know, at its heart for graphics cards, for GPUs. And this next-gen memory is likely to show up on some of the mid-range or upper mid-range graphics cards, next-gen graphics cards coming from the big players.
Cool. So you think it's mainstream or high-end stuff that we're going to see this? I mean, I remember when GDDR5X came out, we saw it only in the higher-end SKUs like the 1080 Ti. What do you think? Is this sort of broad swath across the entire portfolio of next-gen GPUs from either NVIDIA or AMD?
It's not going to be the entire portfolio. I don't think there's going to be overlap at the high end, but I think the high end is going to be HBM2. And then this will fill out another big chunk, and probably the lower end will still be using GDDR5. I don't know. I mean, unless this is cheaper. One thing to keep in mind is all of the chips that were announced, they're only 1 gigabyte. So 8 chips is only 8 gigabytes of memory, which is leaning more towards a mainstream card. So we'll see how it all shakes out, but, I think this is the foundational announcement we need before the next gen of graphics cards gets announced.
Right. And I mean, AMD traditionally has been mostly HBM2 in the high end, as you noted. So the fact that they've stated volume production indicates that they're obviously shipping for volume manufacturing, pick and placement on graphics cards somewhere, or at least in applications that use the memory in graphics memory, GDDR memory. That is the application. So we can deduce, therefore, that something new is coming soon. And we got a little peek at something. Actually, John, if you went back to that graphic, because this is an interesting correlation that we should pick up on for folks. If you went back to that, yeah, there you go. There's the layout of the GDDR6 implementation that they're talking about with the GPU. Now, if we flip to First Look, a headline called First Look, NVIDIA Next Gen Turing GeForce GTX Prototype Card Spotted. You will notice on that prototype card, at least we think it's a next generation Turing prototype card from NVIDIA, you'll notice a very similar topography of GPU and graphics memory layout. Now, this is nothing new. I think GDDR5 and 5X share the same layout, but there it is. If you zoomed in close, it's kind of hard to see it there, but you can see the GPU in the center of that layout, and then the memory scattered around its perimeter on three sides. So what do we think about this, Marco? Is this the real deal? It's looking pretty Frankenstein too, by the way.
Looking Frankenstein. Now, part of Micron's announcement was also that they've expanded their ecosystem to work more closely with partners to ease engineering efforts to implement GDDR6. So yeah. What I think that card is, because you'll notice it's got a bunch of extra fingers at the top. It's got three power connectors, so it's, you know, got a whole bunch of power options on there. The crazy fan setup. It's got a PCI Express X16 connector on there, but that's obviously not a car that's destined for consumers. I think that is a reference platform just to test GDDR6 and get the implementation right. And that particular setup is a 384-bit interface using 12 chips, so it would be a very high-end card. It's totally possible NVIDIA's next-gen super high-end card is going to, you know, use GDDR6. It's more likely, I think, going to be a 256-bit interface on a mainstream card, and the top ends will have HBM. I'm speculating. I don't know. But yeah, I think that's an engineering vehicle just to make sure GDDR6 is working as expected and that they can have all the timings and all the tweaking and tuning done right. But what's shown in that picture is not likely to ever appear anywhere where someone's going to buy it.
Yeah, no, that's that's clearly a test vehicle for either GPU or memory. But you made some interesting deductions there. A picture's worth 1,000 words, as they say, and you might dismiss that quickly as, oh, this is some Franken thing that, you know, you're right, it's never going to see the light of day, but you can learn a lot from it. And what you observed there was, what was the interface, 384-bit memory interface? 384-bit,
yeah, 12 packages on there, yeah.
12 packages, yeah, so you've got that. So it's a wide memory footprint for a wide memory bus, I should say bus width, for a higher end GPU, and interesting. It's also got three PCI Express power connectors on there for a crap load of power supply. Yep. But you know, you get fans on there, you get all kinds of crazy stuff. I wonder what those fans are cooling. Probably, you know, voltage power arrays or something like that, regulators or something. But
I mean, there's no heat sink in the pick, so
very strange. Yeah. So it's funny what leaks out and what gets out into the interwebs. But it would appear that we're getting close. And when a manufacturer like Micron ships for volume, there it's to an assembly line of some sort somewhere, or at least to bring up and prototype. And prototypes sometimes can be thousands of boards, right? So that's volume. But and we remember, you know, not too long ago, maybe a month or two ago, I think it was E3, maybe Jensen Huang, the CEO of NVIDIA, came out and said the next gen GeForce not soon, I think was his comment or something like that. So he was playing it off, but who knows? Well, I think it's this year, right? We would speculate that it's this year sometime.
Yeah, a few months. I booked a vacation for end of summer, so everything's probably going to land the week I'm gone.
Right. Yeah. Just to piss you and me off. Yeah,
exactly. No,
it's all good. But yeah, well, it's interesting stuff. GDDR6 gives you higher bandwidth, better signal integrity. It's the next evolution of GDDR. HBM2, still costly to manufacture, but gobs of bandwidth.
I should hedge my bet. You know, I'm gonna hedge my bet a little bit. The really high speed GDDR6 kind of blurs the line between in terms of performance with some of the current HBM2 implementations. Yeah, you can still get more bandwidth and a wider bus with the HBM2, but you know, availability is not quite there, or wide availability is not quite there. It's caused some supply issues in the past. So it's entirely possible that GDDR6 does ride this next wave. I mean, Pascal's over 2 years old at this point. So a next gen GPU with a 30% bump in memory bandwidth that also utilizes that bandwidth more efficiently, maybe you don't need HBM2. So we'll see.
Well, and we've seen two very distinct approaches to the market. AMD riding the HBM2 wave much earlier, coming out with HBM1, then HBM2, and having consumer boards out with HBM. NVIDIA has not done that. They've reserved HBM for their much higher margin AI accelerators and other GPUs for machine learning and maybe even workstation stuff. So it would make sense that if they can get the bandwidth out of GDDR6, which they can, that they probably still follow that model. There's a lot of cost in chip and wire manufacturing. It's the packaging and the substrate manufacturing and the expense of that comes with HBM. So, yeah, that would make sense. I would agree with you. It could happen.
Yep.
That it's more GDDR6. We shall see. It's fun to watch. It's fun to speculate, but always something new and exciting coming down the pipe, and that's why we do what we do, because tech keeps evolving. We will get to a question from a reader that chimed in. By the way, I'm going to butcher this name, Sintelalias here, sent in a question which we will get to next. But first, Chris, you spent some quality time with an absolutely beastly machine. I'm surprised it didn't abduct you in the middle of your sleep or something, because it's a monster. Alienware Area 51 R5, the fifth coming of this machine. Beautiful photography, by the way, Christopher. Well done.
Thank
liquid you. Liquid cooled GPUs and Skylake X firepower. Something new with this dual liquid cooled GPU. Something they haven't done before, right? Good stuff.
Right. So yeah, for Alienware, this is the first time that they have liquid cooled the GPUs along with the CPU. Of course, they've done liquid cooling for the CPU in the past, probably forever. But the GPU liquid cooling, even in the DIYer space, is still relatively rare. There's a couple companies I know. Corsair makes a liquid cooling block for certain graphics cards, but when you get into non-reference designs and stuff, it gets a lot more difficult to do. So it is nice to see that in a system that's not necessarily a boutique build, because Alienware, it's got its very firm production roots as it is owned by Dell. So it's really nice to see that kind of extension come to a system like this that's more accessible for mainstream users. Not that a $7,000 desktop would be mainstream, but there is a lot to the system that you could pare down and still get the liquid cooled GPUs if that's really what you're after. So right now, they're only offering the liquid cooling option on the GTX 1080s, and you can do that as a single or dual SLI cards. And we have the SLI set up here. They also offer, 1080 Ti's, dual 1080 Ti's, and I would expect that to come, a little more in the future or whatever the next generation equivalent is. But I think it makes sense to see it in a more mainstream setup like dual 1080s now, because there is a significant amount of engineering work that goes into it. But as far as this system goes, it's pretty absurd. I mean, it's got the Intel Core i9-7980XE inside, which is an 18-core chip with 36 threads. So probably doesn't make the most sense if you're just gaming, but if you're streaming and coding video, doing 3D renders, any number of megatasking stuff, doing it all at once, like throwing workstation workloads on it that you also want to game with, it's a really fantastic system for that. Even at $6,000 for what you're getting here, you're getting a lot. It's really nice to handle. Sorry, I have it just off camera here, so I'm looking at it. I guess I could show you.
There you go. There's the spaceship. Yeah, so, no, it's interesting stuff, and we should note that the config that Dell Alienware sends into sites like ours, where we're testing and benchmarking, all of these, whether it be boutique or high end system builders like Dell in the volume space, they're sending in is your basic cherry pick. Gear this thing up to blow out the benchmarks, because they all want to be in the top of the chart. So yeah, you get the $7,000 config. But I think what's entry level in this thing? I want to say it's right around
1800.
Yeah, 1800 is what I was going to say. Yeah,
something like that.
And you can configure a whole lot of firepower, just for the basic, maybe you go 6-core and a single 1080 Ti or something like that. And have room to grow. What's interesting, or what I found great about that machine, is that it's an entirely toolless affair. You can get into it, you can get in the side of it real easy, little lever pulls off the side, and then to get into it, it's all, there's like really well engineered press fit, retention brackets and different things for the graphics cards. Right. And you can almost do
extra cables.
Yeah,
they've got extra cables run for everything. So there's power cables, SATA cables already there for you if you just want to pop in drives. Something like the main gear you looked at is like absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, if you want to change something out, you know, that's all custom tubing, piping going through it. You know, there's a lot that almost takes an engineering degree to upgrade, where this, you could start with a more basic system and, you know, upgrade it as you go. And it legitimately can grow with you for years as you continue to easily upgrade it.
Yeah, that, you make a good point. What's different about, I mean, certainly the main gear rig is, you know, another level expensive and crazy performant, high-end, beautiful work of art. But it's not very user serviceable, very user friendly, because you want to pull the GPU, you want to pull a CPU, you're breaking down the liquid self-contained, you know, or the entirely, I should say, radiator and liquid loop. open loop setup. So it's a lot, but this is designed for modularity, and you can get into it real easy. The other thing that impresses me about that rig, how did you find the thermals? I've found, when I've looked at it before, and I've looked at a couple of versions of it, that surprisingly, the way they engineered that with the triad design, you've got cool air blowing it, you know, being sucked in with a couple of fans up front, and then it pushes out the back, exhausts out the back in an upward direction, you know, so the whole thing just kind of flows really well, and this thermally seems pretty efficient.
Right. Yeah. Well, the nice thing about that triad design is you can't put it up against something that's going to block airflow unless you've got a really funky desk. So it is going to keep that. It's going to breathe well just by its design, because it takes up space, and that's there. For thermals on this, really not an issue at all, even under regular loads. It wasn't until I threw FirmMark at it and Prime 95 that it got hot, and that was only with the overclocking profile. So this does come with, you know, the base clocks for the CPU, and they also have a profile to take the CPU clocks on two cores up to 4.7 gigahertz, and then the rest of the cores run at 4.2 gigahertz, which is much better than, I think, the 3.4 gigahertz all core you get if you have 18 cores under load at stock speeds. So it does make a nice big improvement with a single click there. If you're absolutely crushing it, even the liquid cooling it's still going to hit that 90C threshold and start to throttle a little bit. But for most loads, for gaming, for anything that's not stressing absolutely every core, you're going to be fine. You're going to see temps in the 60s, maybe 70s at worst, under load. The GPUs, it's almost impossible, even with FirmMark running, to get them above 50C. So really nice and cool there. What I do wish is that they also had a overclocking profile for the GPUs on there. You can go in there and do, you know, your Afterburner or Precision, whatever you want to do on your own. But, you know, if you're going to liquid cool the GPUs in a system like this, why not make it easy, especially for a more mainstream audience that isn't necessarily, you know, they're not the group that's necessarily out building their own PCs. They just want a game. So
yeah,
make it easy.
Yeah. So Alienware, Dell Alienware put together some new software, the new Command Center software. There's no hooks built into that. It's more, I know it's heavily game library focused, and no hooks for that in there.
So that's where the overclocking profile for the CPU lives. You can monitor the GPUs in there, but there's nothing to overclock them, even manually, using that software at this point.
Gotcha.
But again, yeah, that is new software. They were showing it off at CES when I was there, still pretty new then. So it may be coming. It's just not there yet.
So some feedback for the folks at Dell, if you're listening, which they probably are. So yeah, a little add that little feature in there. Any other caveats for the average mainstream user that might be considering this not so mainstream rig?
Yeah, I mean, if you keep in mind that this thing is gigantic, it took two of us to carry it up the stairs. It comes in a giant box, 60-something pounds. I was originally going to set it up on the desk behind me as, you know, a test area. I ended up having to put it on my main desk because that desk was not going to support it. So you want to make sure you have the space and desk strength to support it. I guess you could put it on the floor, but a system this big and bold, you do want out on display, I think. So that's something to keep in mind. Other than that, the most interesting part I thought was demonstrated through the review, through the benchmarking, was the shift you see with all these cores and the processing power that'll really help you out at lower resolutions. So 1080p benchmarks, it's even beating dual 1080 Ti systems. But then as it shifts upward to higher resolutions, then the GPU really becomes the limiting factor. And so you see the, you know, the 1080 Ti start to dominate again, and it falls back a little more. So something to keep in mind if you are speccing out a system for yourself, you really want to think about what your monitor is. In this case, they also sent the beautiful 34-inch curved G-Sync 100 hertz, 120 hertz overclockable curved gaming monitor, which this is very well suited for. I'm getting almost 120 FPS in basically everything. It has G-Sync for when I'm not. So that's an excellent pairing, but you do want to keep your monitor in mind when you're speccing out a system like this or whatever else you're doing.
Good stuff, Chris. So you're gonna let them pry it out of your cold hands to go back to the shop?
I mean, it's going to be an effort to get it back out of my office. I don't know. It might take a while.
Might take a while. It looks good in those pictures. It looks like it's nicely at home there in the main labs of Hot Hardware. Good stuff. The folks at Dell with the Alienware Area 51 R5, the Alienware gaming division of Dell. They bought Alienware way back in the day out of Miami, still located in Miami, their headquarters down there. Producing great stuff these days, you know, really innovative new designs. I think the Area 51's probably, you know, it's in its R5, you know, Revision 5 iteration, probably due for a refresh soon, but it is a very unique chassis design and setup that's super user-friendly, serviceable. You get lots of room to grow in it. Good stuff. Cool. Well, let's move on real quick to something that I find interesting, and that is the technologies that comprise home networking these days, and what you can do to improve not only your home network performance, but your coverage and then cost. And we checked out Chris on our team, Chris Ledishin. I'm going to say his name hopefully properly. Another Chris, a Chris of a different ilk. The Netgear Orbi Mesh Router with Cable Modem Review. There you go. That's a mouthful. It is the Netgear Orbi. I'm going to call it the Cable Orbi because that's what the folks at Netgear form it to. The Cable Orbi that you see right there is comprised of a 802.11ac Wi-Fi router with mesh technology and a DOCSIS 3 cable modem all in one. And it's designed such that obviously, you know, as you can see from the industrial styling, it's a pretty design. It's designed to, you know, be out on a tabletop somewhere and blend in with the scenery. But it's, it's built to take care of two requirements in the home network. You're probably leasing if you're on a cable network versus fiber, or, you know, if you're fortunate enough to be on a fiber connection, you're probably on a cable modem connection with a hybrid fiber coax from somebody like Cox or Comcast, like me, what have you, Charter, and you are leasing a cable modem from them. In that lease is, you know, maybe a $10 or $15 a month charge for the use of the equipment, and you don't have to do that. So what this does for $399 for the kit, which includes that cable modem router combination unit that you saw earlier. John, I don't know if you can get that back up on the screen. There's also a neat little diagram underneath it that would be good for a visual. That kit replaces your cable modem on a hybrid fiber coax setup, you know, with one of the companies, and gives you that a satellite as well. And you can see there in the picture the satellite setup. So this is a mesh network, and mesh networking is all the rage these days, because you have problems in even an average size home with signal strength punching through walls, punching through levels. And what this does is allow you to extend your range and your signal strength. Now, sure, you can have a cable modem on the bottom floor, whether it be in the basement where your cable line comes in and your router right there. And sure, you can get Wi-Fi signal up through the second floors or even third floor of the house, but it degrades at every level. So you put a satellite in the mesh network, for example, in this case, Orbi's satellite, up on a second floor or even on a third floor. And it's relaying the signal, not just the crappy extender way, but in the case of Netgear, there's a dedicated backhaul channel. So essentially what you're talking about is really two 802.11 Wi-Fi network setups at work here. So you've got the original, you know, the base router that's built into the cable modem in this case. And then in the satellite, you've got another router set up, and they communicate with each other. And what makes Netgear interesting is they have a dedicated backhaul channel. So you're not just sharing the links that your clients, whether it be a notebook or whatever, is tapping into the Wi-Fi, your handset. They're not sharing that connection with the clients. It's on the back end, dedicated, going back to the router. So it's really as true a, you know, what they call a mesh topography, as true a relay of the Wi-Fi network through that dedicated backhaul that that you can have. It's not siphoning off the client side link to transmit data. This has existed in the enterprise for a while. Higher end networking systems, you know, with access points that have that dedicated backhaul, have existed in the enterprise. More expensive equipment. The technologies have just been evolved and designed as of late to support a consumer level product. And that's what you're seeing with the advent of mesh technologies, the mesh home network routers. What's unique about this is Netgear built in the cable modem. Performance we found was good. Certainly better than a non-mesh network in terms of, you know, extended range and throughput over that distance. Performance on the cable modem side was also good. It's DOCSIS 3. There's a couple of caveats here. It's DOCSIS 3 only. So if you have, there you go. There's the base and the satellite, and they're attractive. You can put the satellite up in another room and it looks great on a coffee table or whatever. it's DOCSIS 3 though. So you won't get the highest end DOCSIS 3.1 spec that supports gigabit cable. That's not available. The other thing that's not available in this kit is voice over IP support. So in the case of, let's say you're a cable provider that gives you the cable modem and a VoIP connection for your phone, you don't get that. You're going to need the voice over IP box if you run your phone over your cable line as well. A lot of folks don't these days. They're using cell phones instead of the landline. God knows I should just drop the landline altogether myself. So it's a good solution, you know, and for $399 kind of wraps everything up. You can get off the monthly fee for renting your cable modem from your ISP and extend your range a little bit with the mesh. What are you thinking about this, Mark? I know you played with Orbi stuff a little bit.
I think it's cool. It's kind of pricey out of the gate, you know. For you can get just the main router with built-in cable modem, I believe, for $299. The kit that we reviewed with a satellite that can cover up to 4,000 square feet is currently selling for $399. I believe MSRP is $449, but it sells everywhere at $399. It seems pricey out of the gate, but when you consider that you drop that rental fee for the cable modem, becomes more attractive because it will eventually pay for itself over time.
Yeah.
And having the mesh, so the dedicated backhaul is important. Like if people have set up traditional extenders in the past, not mesh extenders, but like the traditional extenders, you're basically having your Wi-Fi throughput. It uses the Wi-Fi. It has to relay data back and forth. It essentially cuts your bandwidth in half. The dedicated backhaul is just, think of it as replacing an Ethernet cable between two access points. It's got its own dedicated channel. So it is a superior technology, single SSID. I like the Orbi stuff. In terms of all of the consumer class mesh stuff on the market, it seems the Orbis have the least issues and are the most liked amongst the community and people I've talked to. So I think it's a cool little kit. I just wish they were a little less expensive.
Yeah. Another kit that does well, that's also a mesh kit, by the way, is the Linksys Velop, I want to say. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
So they're also a pretty potent kit that has a dedicated backhaul setup as well. There's lots of these mesh kits out there, and not all of them work the same. They're a little bit lighter on the backlink. It's interesting technology. It's something that, you know, we used to be, you'd buy your router and forget it for a couple of three years and until you had a problem and you needed to upgrade. Now it's like there's compelling technology almost every year in the router space. And, whether it be multi-user MIMO over 802.11ac, I mean, with, having multiple clients and being able to, divide that bandwidth up and have dedicated connections like that. It's great. Wi-Fi is getting better and better all the time. And pretty soon we'll have municipal Wi-Fi and we won't, we'll just tap into the cloud network, right?
But it's funny. So all of these new features coming to the Wi-Fi side are kind of lost on me. And I'm going to explain why. So the Ethernet out of these routers is all gigabit. I think there's a couple now that are multi-gig, but then you need multi-gig everywhere on your network. So you have these Wi-Fi connections capable of greater than gigabit speeds. Mm. And it's even if you have a client that can do those kind of speeds, an MU-MIMO client is capable of that, connecting to anything outside the router is still gigabit. So the thing that appeals to me with the new routers are the faster processors and the more RAM and allow you to connect more devices. Getting an AC 3200 or AC 4000, blah, 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 that's less important to me. It's more about getting those faster processors and more memory in the router, because then you can have, even the slightest lower, ping times out to the web, and it can handle more devices without bogging down. But that increased Wi-Fi performance is sort of, it's a checkbox feature, but most people aren't really, they think they're getting to take advantage of it when they're really not.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. As interesting I'm still stuff. Sitting here on 100 megabit internet. As I'm still sitting here on 100 megabit internet, which is better than I was getting, I'll say. But, it's going to take a while for those incoming pipes to catch up, but latency is huge. That's why things like this Alienware have killer networking on board that can help prioritize stuff. And any little thing you can do to reduce latency is going to make things like your gaming experience that much better.
Traffic shaping, yes. Packet prioritization, that's also important stuff too. So let's move along, and actually let's take a quick step aside to answer a reader question. And I'm hoping, again, I get this name right, but Sintelas is here, is how I'm going to say that, asked a question on one of our last webcasts, and I'm hoping Marco, off the top of your smart little beanie, can pull this, pull this out of your head. Could you do a $500 PC build, or at least say what parts you'd use for games like CSGO, Rust, Fortnite, or other similar games? Please and thanks. In other words, what would you recommend for a cheap $500 PC build, gaming PC build for fast Twitch gaming?
Tough to say right now, right? Because memory prices suck and SSD prices, for me personally, right? Let's say you set a budget of $500, whatever your budget is. I would prioritize personally, or not that I'd prioritize. I personally wouldn't want to build a rig with less than 8 gigs of RAM, without an SSD, and at least a quad core. So, and now if you want a game, a GPU, a discrete GPU is probably a must. So if you absolutely have to keep it below $500, and I'd have to check out pricing, I'm probably off on a few things here. You're most likely going to do best with a Ryzen 5 with a mainstream motherboard, at least 8 gigs of really fast RAM. Use that onboard Vega GPU because games like CSGO will definitely run on it. Fortnite will run on it. Not going to be fantastic, but will definitely run on it. But I would probably look towards that platform, find the best deals on memory and an SSD, and if you have any money left over, pour it into GPU. I'd have to really map it out though to say for sure.
So you're saying Raven Ridge, so integrated AMD GPU. Is that what you said?
Well, yeah, because memory prices are so high and you really need an SSD with a decent capacity, it just makes everything else better. So figure if you're going to have a Steam library on an SSD, you're probably at minimum want a 480 gigger. You can get by with smaller and throw a hard drive in, but I don't know. You get spoiled when you have the SSD. So if you're figuring, you know, half a terabyte of solid state storage plus memory prices through the roof, you know, the SSD and memory alone are probably, you know, approaching $300. Yeah. So that leaves very little left for everything else.
Yeah.
If you have some parts laying around. So that the priority for me, and it because CSGO was mentioned, then it's, you know, that game is so old and it'll run on lots of hardware. A Raven Ridge will probably be good because if you put fast memory in there and overclock it, it's pretty good for 1080p gaming. Not fantastic, but you have basically the latest generation AMD graphics core with all the software goodness that comes from AMD without spending a ton of money. And then if you add a GPU later, you still have a nice quad core processor in there. So, and it wasn't, and it's kind of affordable. So it seems like the logical choice. Again, I'd have to go look at prices and see what deals are out there and map it all out. But off the top of my head, that's what comes to mind.
Sound like a plan. Chris, would you echo that or add any other suggestions and twists?
Yeah, I'd be right along those same lines. It can be tempting to go with a hard drive still for capacity, but quality of life-wise, it's really hard to go back to a hard drive boot disk system. So yeah, definitely going to echo the SSD. 8 gigs is kind of where we are for a minimum these days. Again, for quality of life, even doing basic tasks on a 4 gig system, you're going to run into slowdowns sooner or later. So yeah, you've got the core parts there. Raven Ridge is a great option. Pretty hard to offer anything else than what you've got.
Yeah. And then you get room to grow in there. You can always drop a discrete GPU in and up your game down the road when you get a few more pesos to pour into it. Cool. Well, we answered
just
that question.
Just quickly for giggles, I hopped in onto Newegg just to check some prices. So a 500 gig SSD and 8 gigs of RAM, you're already over $200, right? So actually, that's cheaper than I thought it would be. I guess SSD prices have been dropping. So, and that's at least DDR4 3200. You want to use fast memory in today's system. So, and that's sort of the sweet spot, the DDR4 3200. So, yep, Raven Ridge. Fast SSD and memory, and then whatever money you have left after you pick your case and PSU, poured into a discrete GPU.
And this show was not sponsored by AMD. that's we're just being honest. That's exactly the suggestion there. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Sorry, Francois.
So, all right, let's. Yeah, let's move on and actually transition on that note to something AMD related again. Actually Kyer Howard chimed in on and said, "I think we all can agree that 7-nanometer Zen 2 will be a home run." Well, that remains to be seen, but I would not argue that it has potential. TSMC hits volume production of 7-nanometer silicon with AMD Zen 2 and Vega 7-nanometer incoming this year. Marco, are you forecasting in the tea leaves that this is going to be greatness incarnate?
I think so. And here's why. So I'm 95% certain Lisa Su, AMD CEO, has disclosed that AMD is going to be splitting 7-nanometer production between TSMC and GlobalFoundries. I'm not exactly sure which product lines are going where, if it's both, so that they make sure they have capacity, if they're confident that both foundries are going to offer similar performance. You know, you don't want to have two of the same CPUs out on the market and behaving totally differently because it was two different foundries. So I'm not sure how that's all going to play out, but with the TSMC news that they've hit volume production, AMD has already disclosed that they have a 7-nanometer Radeon GPU coming. That is the, you know, obviously coming from TSMC's 7-nanometer process. They've also disclosed that the next generation EPYC processors, so they're not going to do what they did on the consumer side where Ryzen went from 14-nanometer to 12-nanometer plus with the second generation. The true, you know, in the enterprise space, you want those longer sort of lifespans, and the true next generation EPYCs are 7-nanometer processors. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? So I think it means a lot of good stuff. So I haven't seen data direct from TSMC on what 14 the difference between 14-nanometer and 7-nanometer means, but on GlobalFoundries, they've said a greater than 40% area improvement, greater than 60% power reduction, and up to 30% lower die cost. So what that means is you can do many more transistors on a die that's still economical to produce within that target power envelope. So I think it's awesome news for, and then Zen 2 is also going to have architectural improvements. So I think AMD is going to cram more cores into the dies that are going to be used on those EPYC processors. So there's potential for some crazy core counts on next gen EPYC within the same power envelopes, potentially even lower power envelopes with higher clocks. So it assuming that the transistors are going to function well and that the execution is there, it is looking like a home run if they're already in volume production.
Yeah. No, and I guess we should underscore something there. That the 7-nanometer silicon that's coming, you know, most likely for AMD through TSMC will be EPYC. It will be server class product first. You may see 7-nanometer Vega. That's also professional workstation targeted first, right? We're not diving right into this year anyways, shipping this year. We're not diving right into consumer product right away with 7-nanometer for these, right?
So what was disclosed, there's no consumer parts that were disclosed. The 7-nanometer Radeon Vega that was talked about is destined for Radeon Instinct. I believe they showed one with 32 gigs of HBM2, and that is targeting, you know, machine learning, AI applications, Radeon Instinct cards. And obviously, EPYC is not a desktop processor. It's data center workstation part. So, yes. And it makes sense. You know, moving to a new process is always risky. And no matter what the foundries tell you, they're you know, whatever the foundry probably said to AMD in terms of capacity and yield, it's probably going to be lower for the first runs until they work out all the kinks. So it makes sense to go with the lower volume parts and, you know, see what they can do from there.
Yeah. But it's exciting. And what's fascinating in this whole thing with 7-nanometer is that Intel, for the first time in many years, seems to be behind the curve with 10-nanometer pushed to 2019. And so, you know, if you look at it just right on paper, you've got, you know, at best 14-nanometer Intel versus, you know, at least in the high end for these workstation and server chips, as well as workstation GPUs, 7-nanometer technology that's at least being introduced in 2018. I don't think they're going to hit volume on this, AMD, until early 2019, but Intel's not even there with 10-nanometer until 2019. So yeah, it's a surprising turning of the tables, just at a time when the architecture as well for AMD has gotten competitive, you know, immensely competitive. And so it will be wild to watch. And I think Intel is really, you know, running flat out right now to you know, turn the crank as hard as they can, because they've got some serious competition. And amazingly, you know, they're referred to as Chipzilla because, you know, their fab prowess, their manufacturing technology is world class. It has always been, you know, you can't compete with the manufacturing workhorse that is Intel. You just can't. Well, now we've got a combination in a fabulous semiconductor company like AMD that can. So wild stuff. I don't think we've ever seen this dynamic from a manufacturing standpoint, right? For Intel.
You know, traditionally, yeah, Intel was the nobody for a long time. Everybody said nobody builds transistors like Intel, but there's, you know, there's so few foundries, and then you have these, you know, dedicated places like TSMC, and now then you have companies like AMD and NVIDIA, you know, learning how to really optimize their designs for this sort of, you know, fabless model, and making sure that they're tuning their designs for the particular fabs and, you know, the particular foundries they're working with. The synergy is just better than it was years ago. It's just how it works, as the nature of the beast. So yeah, I mean, it's funny. I've been thinking about the Intel situation because the rumors were, you know, there is that one 10 nanometer part out, but the GPU is disabled and the CPUs work.
Right.
Yeah. And now it's like, well, if they can make 10, I'm sure yield isn't there, but if they can make the CPUs work, maybe it's a GPU design flaw and not necessarily something with 10 nanometer. Again, I don't know. I'm literally just thinking out loud.
Is this what I suggested last week?
No, you did. So I'm one, and then you have Raja coming on board. So is the delay to 2019 because it's actually a problem with 10 nanometer, or did they decide to just go with a new design and it's just going to be 2019 when it happens, you know, or 2020?
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's just so much happening. It's literally dizzying. So we just have to ride out this wave and keep reporting on it.
Yeah. 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 I know.
I would think.
Go ahead, Chris.
I would think with market share too, because Intel still has a massive market share lead at this point, when they're producing a product, they have to produce a lot more of that product. So their yield demand is going to be very, very high too, possibly in comparison.
Yeah. And then the funny thing is with this community, right? So right now, all of the buzz and all the hype and all of the love is with AMD. If Intel launches some really nice part, that wave will shift like that. You know, mm-hmm. it's just how this community is. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's there's no question about it. Certainly there's this underdog effect right now for AMD, but technologists and enthusiasts love better technology. So excuse me, I'm losing my voice. Yeah. I love better technology. And you know, that trumps all. When you've got a great product at a great price that technologically is more advanced, you will win. So bring it.
Unless you're beta
good
max.
Stuff. What's that? Unless you're beta max.
Yeah. Unless you're beta max.
Yeah, I guess it's not always a slam dunk. Yeah. Yeah. So let's move on, and we'll wrap up pretty quick here to actually an interesting even further evolution of the fabulous semiconductor company, where a company is not only fabulous, they don't manufacture their own silicon, but they integrate quite a bit of another company's IP in terms of processor cores with their own IP as well. And I'm speaking of Qualcomm. They have introduced, or at least I should say, I'm not sure if that was an official introduction. Shame on me. So Qualcomm Snapdragon 1000 chip was rumored in the pipeline to further the Windows 10 ARM on Windows laptop ecosystem, always connected PC based on Qualcomm technology, which is an ARM core based processor. ARM, of course, a licensing company for many cores that go in lots of different you know, cell phone technologies, from Android to even Apple, who builds their own custom ARM based processors. What do we know about the Snapdragon 1000, and was it rumor? Am I just you know, talking in the breeze here? Marco, help!
Oh, sorry. Oh. I thought you were kicking it off to Chris. I'm so sorry.
Oh, well, no, it's roundtable. We're roundtable. Yeah.
So you know the details on the 1000, they were basically saying that the Snapdragon 1000 chip could bring performance like Intel U series chips to those Windows 10 portables. Now, in terms of architectural differences that are in there, I don't think too much was disclosed that I see, except that it's likely to be using the new A76 cores and have higher TDPs than you're used to seeing in mobile and smaller mobile devices. So, these Snapdragon-based devices, I haven't spent enough time to have a real solid opinion. I can't really make any real firm statements on them because I haven't spent enough time with them. But if they were blowing up the consumer space, they'd be everywhere, and they're not. So they're not. There are quirks, things to contend with. They're not ideal solutions. Battery life can be good if you're not trying to emulate lots of Win32 apps. But in my opinion, it's because the current platforms, they're really not perfectly optimized for this. And knowing that Microsoft's working on this, Qualcomm is definitely going to optimize designs to handle the Microsoft emulation layer better, to have their architecture be more efficient running this stuff. And they're also going to play with that additional size with these form factors to optimize performance. So you're looking at with the Snapdragon 1000, more memory support. I believe gigabit LTE built in on the platform, plus the latest, 802.11 Wi-Fi, access to faster storage setup. So it should mean a really significant update to those machines. Just it's hard to say based on the information that's out there now.
Yeah, the net I took from this, and it was a lot of it was, there was some leak, basically. This isn't anything official. But the net I took away from it was, Cortex A76, which is next generation ARM. Chris, you know all about that stuff. You were briefed on it. Cortex A76, no longer in a single digit TDP. So where we see current Windows on ARM devices, Qualcomm Snapdragon on Windows devices that are out in the market today, and even the 850 that was announced, which is a goose of the 845, Snapdragon 845. You're really talking, for all intents and purposes, smartphone optimized silicon at very low TDPs, single digit TDPs, 4 or 5 watts tops. This is a 15 watt TDP solution, is what we're being. What we're being told, or what we're being led to believe, and 15 watt TDP, Cortex A76, 16 gig of RAM, LPDDR4X is what was quoted, and larger storage, 128 gig flash drives. So, could be an interesting alternative and a much more potent Snapdragon powered PC. Chris, what do you know about A76? Is this kind of the type of implementation they'd go with?
So when I was in Texas with ARM, they did say that the A76 was going to start making its way into consumer, produced chips, hopefully by the end of this year, early 2019. So it matches the timeline, I think, based on what we could expect from this. The A76 is a architectural redesign versus the A72 or the A75 before. So there is a lot more efficiency available in there. It can shrink right down to 5 nanometers they were discussing. So we'll probably, we're going to see the 7 nanometer variant of it here, which they were pitching as the high performance process, and then it will also be available with the A76 on 12 nanometer for more mainstream stuff. So I think it definitely is lining up to look like an A76 core in the Snapdragon 1000. I think it is interesting to see it at this point with the higher TDPs, because they were discussing bringing in active cooling solutions for some laptops, things to really get more performance out of it, because it's very nice and efficient. You could scale it down, get a lot of performance even on passive cooling. But it's kind of like we've seen with the different, eras of Gorilla Glass, where, Gorilla Glass comes out and says, hey, we have this new stronger glass, and so do we think that makes phones more durable? No, manufacturers are taking that, making thinner displays. So, you know, they're trying to push as much as they can out of it. And it's kind of the same thing here. So, yes, the chips are getting more efficient, more powerful, but the manufacturers want even more. They're going to push those clock speeds up, especially to keep up and try and make a dent in the laptop market with those always-on devices. They're going to push the envelope.
Yeah, yeah. Cool stuff. We'll see what happens. It's not an official, but it's being rumored that Qualcomm is upping their game and targeting bigger iron for notebooks. So we shall see. And Qualcomm also came out with the Snapdragon 439 and 632 SoC Trio announcement. These are new low-power Snapdragon SoCs for smartphones. Specifically, the 600 series has done very well. This is an optimization next-generation technology on their lower cost, lower power for more mainstream phones. Chris, you've been a fan of the Motorola, the Moto Z Play, I think, was it, that deploys the previous generation 600 series, right?
Yeah, so I've used both the Moto Z Play and the Z2 Play, which use the Snapdragon 625 and 626, respectively. Yeah. The 632 is looking like the evolution of that 626 chip. It's going to be using Cortex A53 cores in it. So those are going to be the more low-power cores to the A75, A76 variant, but they're still very capable. They're just, you know, more optimized for things like battery life or, you're texting, emailing, lower end tasks versus what you'd be using for mobile gaming, perhaps. Not that they couldn't do that. It would just be.
Yeah, I think on the 632, they're actually going with Cairo 250. The 400 series is going with the A53. Yeah, so it's the 400 series is the A53. So now they've got basically a cut of the Snapdragon 845, which is Cairo core. So interesting. They're claiming on the 600 series, the 632 specifically, 40% boost in performance. I hope it comes with the same kind of amazing battery life that made you so fond of that Motorola phone, right?
Hopefully. I mean, you could never really get enough battery life in your phone. Nobody wants to be stuck to a charger all day.
Yeah, yeah. And they've really that is a fantastic chip. If you're not a heavy duty graphics user gamer, and you're just doing, you know, your basic, not basic, but your standard issue mainstream smartphone use, really what's 90% of the market, right? Email, web browsing, calling, texting. Have a nice day.
Yep. I use my phone for work. I just need it to work for me and I need it to last. Get through the work day, get through a couple work days, get through the weekend, whatever it takes. You know, if it can play YouTube, Netflix, great. But I need it to be there for me when I've got work to do.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah, man. Hey, so we thought we were going to do a turbo quick show, but we are now at the bottom of the hour. Let's mention real quick before we sign off, though, that we are thinking feverishly about our next giveaway. Marco, we talked about the potential to build it first and they will come. Build it, show it, and then give it away. Or what did we talk about?
I think you know, in the past we've sort of favored, you know, Facebook engagement and comments on the site. I think for the next one, let's engage the YouTube community. We'll build it first, do the build video, get it live, get everybody seeing what's up for grabs, and then we'll give it away after the facts. But the parts and stuff, we still have to work it all out. But I think that's what's going to happen for the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Leave some comments below in the stream video, the VOD here on YouTube, and suggest what you'd like. Would you like an AMD flavor? Would you like an Intel flavor? We can kind of pool our resources with all our manufacturing friends and give us some ideas, and we'll try and make it happen and give it away, because we like to give back when we can to help build community and make more geek friends like us. Yes. Right, guys?
Yes, yes, yes.
All right, so we'll say goodbye. You can find us at hothardware.com on the web. You can find us here at youtube.com/hothardware or hothardwarevids, where we hope you'll subscribe and hit that bell button to be reminded when we go live, like today, streaming at 5:30 on Wednesdays. Twitter.com/hot hardware, where you can tweet with us. YouTube.com, I said that. Facebook.com/hot hardware. We're everywhere. We're like the scourge of the internet, right, fellas?
Instagram, absolutely. Periscope,
all of that. We got all the scopes, Chris. Every one of them. And with that, we will say thanks for stopping by.